Bienvenidos. Welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show. I am your host, as always, Matthew Miranda. Dealing with, in 44 years of life, my very first case of poison ivy. It is fairly contained at this point. It's only near my right, it's on my right arm, near my right wrist, in about, if you're into this sort of detail, like half a dozen fairly gross looking blistery bump things, but it hasn't really spread that much, thankfully. I have absolutely zero idea where I got it. I am not a nature person in the sense that I am not out hiking and sticking my hand into random plants and bushes. Yeah, I have no idea where this came from. It's pretty contained, and I have some kind of a clear itch while. But I've been avoiding scratching it, thankfully. I don't know how long I can hold out. You might be getting one of those, like, civil letter, good Lord, civil war letters for me soon, where it's like, "Dear Ida, it's been 89 days since the infection started. I fear I will never see Tara again." Like, whatever. Hopefully it goes away soon. I've never had poison ivy. I'm very proud of that fact. I never had poison ivy, and I've never been stung by an insect. And those are two streaks that I wanted to go my whole life with. I feel a little sullied right now. I'm not going to lie to you. Poison ivy is not attractive. But it is a sign of a summer that has been spent lived, which it has been, even though I don't know how I got it. This is my last couple of free days before I start teaching my summer class. So I really want to get summery with you today. And as a result, I'll be talking about America's summer pastime, Major League Baseball, and why I think this is the year that I have to break up with Major League Baseball, which is the industry, the business of sport that I have followed the longest continuously on a regular basis. I started following it in 1986 and have been pretty with it all the way through. A lot of changes since then. Most of them I didn't think were necessary, but you put up with things. But there's a point where, you know, I think it's that infernal last grasp of late stage capitalism, where it's not enough to make billions of dollars a year in profit. You have to try to appeal to every single human being in any way, because the shareholders want more. So you keep making changes to the sport, assuming the whole time, well, the diehards aren't going to go anywhere. They love the sport. They're diehards. We can tweak whatever we want. We know they're going to stay. But let's try to appeal to these other people. It's very much what happens similarly, I think, with comic book movies. And I'm very guilty of this as a young child comic nerd. Like, it's hard not to see certain movies, even if you're not sure what the quality is going to be, because you, your whole life, if you had known as a kid, like, oh my God, when you're an adult, the biggest movies in the world and the top actors and the... And it's going to have all this cultural cachet. It's going to be comic book movies. You'd be like, oh my God, like, that's awesome. And some of your favorite characters have come and been made into these larger than life cinematic heroes. But there is a point where you start to see, like, huh, like, this isn't about quality anymore. This is about stretching it. Like you're just diluting the product and assuming the diehards will be there. If we can pull in a few more, like, great. MLB has done this, and there's a few things going on off the field and on the field that have put me at a point where I don't feel like I can ethically or just with my heart, like, follow this business anymore. The same thing happened with the NFL about maybe 10, 15 years ago, where just nothing changed overnight, but it reached the point of I can't stand the owners. I can't stand the media and its coverage of the industry. I don't really like the, you know, the CTE. There was no one to root for. The players were harder to root for. Everything was just there. But baseball had persevered. Here's some of the things going on in the world of Major League Baseball that are just enough is enough. And a lot of this year revolve off the field around what's going on with the Oakland Athletics, if you're not aware. The Oakland A's have been in the Coliseum out in Oakland, California, since 1966. By American standards, that's a long time to be somewhere. The Oakland A's are moving, in all likelihood, this year. Sorry, not this year, but I actually don't even know how soon. But they just they've been going back and forth with different politicians in Nevada to have a stadium built around Las Vegas or in Las Vegas so that they can move and relocate there from Oakland. There was a Nevada special legislative session that was held that's supposed to decide whether or not to approve $600 million in tax subsidies for this new stadium. And the legislative session has questions about the whole deal, one of which is the site. So the A's owner, what's his name? John Fisher. John Fisher has repeatedly claimed that he had to go to Vegas to get a deal because Oakland wasn't willing to step up and make one. And as usual, when owners say this, there's a lot of bullshit going on. Oakland put out, the mayor's office put out a statement indicating that they had taken several steps towards agreeing upon a new stadium and a new plan to keep the A's in Oakland. They had done an environmental impact study. They had taken all sorts of other steps that you would take towards formalizing this process. But one of the questions that the Nevada legislative session is wondering about is when Fisher had an offer for a piece of land. I think it's 55 acres. That's either what they're on now is 55, or there was a offer to go somewhere else near the Oakland area that would be 55 acres. And Fisher rejected it in part because he didn't think it was enough land to successfully build the other kinds of businesses and buildings that every time these owners want to build like a big new sport and entertainment complex, it's not just the stadium anymore. They want the land also because that helps them pitch the lie to the public that, oh, this is going to be economically rejuvenating for the area. Here, look at our plans on all these acres. We're going to do all this commercial development. It never translates, but they always pitch it that way. That's how it gets rammed through. So the legislative session is wondering why Fisher has apparently settled on a 9-acre site in Nevada, which barely, and it's for a domed stadium. So there's literally almost no room outside of those 9 acres for anything but the dome stadium itself. It certainly is not a large enough parcel of land to develop a commercial community around. So why is it that 55 acres wasn't enough near Oakland, but 9 acres is fine near Las Vegas? Also, there have historically been all these complaints about the Coliseum. It's not a beautiful baseball stadium. It's not Camden Yards. It's not Wrigley Field. It's not a friendly confines. It's not Citi Field. It's not a place built with the customer's maximum enjoyment and sight lines in mind. The Coliseum is more of a throwback to, there were a lot of stadiums like that built in the 60s and the 70s. You had the Astrodome. You had Three Rivers Stadium. You had Riverfront Stadium. I think even Fulton County Stadium was kind of like very concrete 70s, not really about the movement after that, beginning with Camden Yards, became about integrating stadiums more, hopefully seamlessly, into like urban environments. So you have a thing like in Pittsburgh right now. Pittsburgh Stadium is one of the most beautiful stadiums in MLB, in part because it is just this jewel that was designed in the middle of the city. Like you watch a game in Pittsburgh, you see bridges, you see buildings, like it looks like it's integrated into the community. Camden Yards had a feel like that. Coliseum is not like that. So not to be romantic about the stadium, but it's bizarre also that the proposed new stadium right now in Nevada would hold 30,000 people. 30,000 seats is very small for a major league stadium. I do not think there's any stadium right now that is that small. When the Mets moved from Shea Stadium to Citi Field, it was a big deal that they downsized. Shea Stadium could hold about 55,000 people. Citi Field holds a little over 40. So it's an unusual decision sometimes, and especially here to act like we need more property and then at the same time be like, okay, we'll move to Vegas where there is way less land and also probably the tiniest stadium in Major League Baseball. How is this a better solution than making it work where you've been for over half a century? The legislative session also wants to know how John Fisher, the owner, is going to finance this. Ballpark designers, experts, people have all said it's a tight squeeze. It's a challenge. Like, it doesn't make any sense. How are you possibly going to develop what you need on this small piece of land to cover everything that you're talking about wanting to do and ensure that it's going to work in terms of just making money, since that's presumably why you're engaged in all this activity of stealing a team from a city that does not want to lose it. The Nevada Independent, a publication out there, has noted that if Fisher, because this is not the first time that it's looked like all systems are go in Vegas and then something goes wrong, so the plan is off. And then, oh, well, there's a new agreement, and then something goes wrong. So there's the possibility that maybe Fisher would think about changing sites. Maybe he would decide this 9-acre little joint is not going to do it for me. If that's the case, though, he would have to go back to the legislature for a new vote, which he doesn't want to have happen because of all the stuff he's had to jump through just to try to get to this point. As of now, Major League Baseball still does not even have a schedule set for the owners to vote on whether or not the A's will relocate, which just means MLB is not positive yet that it will go through. As soon as MLB feels like we have all the ducks are in a row, we know this can happen, they will put it to a vote, and it will probably go through. But again, it's not even like this is a classic case of, oh, jack-off capitalist wants to make a lot more money and doesn't care what he has to do it. It doesn't make sense on a lot of levels, seemingly. Not just the site size, the stadium size, but also, even if you want to engage in the logic of the billionaires at the top looking to profit off this, Oakland is the sixth largest television market in the United States. Las Vegas is 40th. How does it benefit the A's as a franchise or baseball as an industry for a team to uproot itself from somewhere that it has been since literally almost 60 years ago to go to a significantly smaller market? There's been a lot of talk from fans in Las Vegas, players who come from there, such as Bryce Harper, who's now on the Philadelphia Phillies, about the fact that as much as Vegas may yearn for a Major League Baseball team, they don't want they don't want to take someone else's team. They want an expansion. They want a team that starts there on their own. They want a Vegas team that from day one is a Vegas team. They don't want someone else's team. There was a poll that was conducted. I think this might have been on the Nevada Independent, or maybe the legislature did it. It was a poll that accompanied SB1B, which was the ballpark bill for a new A stadium in Vegas, an online poll that accompanied SB1B on the Nevada legislator website. 87% of Nevada people who voted, well, it's online, so who knows where they're from, but 87% of the people who voted online opposed the A's ballpark deal. So you have no obvious benefit going from one market to another. This isn't like, well, okay, we're leaving, the Giants and the Dodgers are leaving Brooklyn and Manhattan, but hey, we're opening up now new markets in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Like, looking forward, it's an obvious win. Like, even if it hurts the heartstrings from a cold, hard cash angle, it makes sense. Well, even from that angle, this doesn't make sense. The city that you're looking to go into is not clamoring to have this team brought there. They have, in fact, pretty definitively shown the opposite. And then Oakland itself doesn't want to lose this team. Oakland had a kind of reverse rally where very recently their attendance has been, you know, abysmal this year because Fisher, as the owner, has made it extremely clear that he doesn't give a single flying beep about any of the people there, about the fans. The Mets played a game in Oakland earlier this year. It was a joke when it came out, the story. They couldn't use the broadcast booth at the Coliseum, the media's allocated space to broadcast games from, because they have like a possum infestation. And there's no rush to get rid of it. This man does not care that he's tearing down something that has meaning to a community of people, that he's tearing down something that the only reason it came into his life as a significant profit-making opportunity is because of the value and the love and the significance that people have infused it with because of their own personal histories and experiences and emotions toward the team. He's just coming in and co-opting that and seeing how he can make, like, and the A's don't spend any money as a team. Like, they don't compete. They don't try to compete. They haven't for a while. So you think, oh, my God, like, what an effed up situation. The other owners can't like this. The commissioner who speaks for them can't like this. Well, now we get to Rob Manfred, MLB commissioner, a.k.a. Super Dick. Manfred had a press conference a few weeks ago with reporters, and a few of the things that he said really stood out as, what is wrong with you? The first was he was asked about the event that happened when the A's fans staged what they called the reverse boycott, which was a game where the fans flooded the stadium and showed up in giant numbers, made like a big party out of it. But they were there with an agenda. We'll talk more about it a little bit later, but they were there, you know, wearing shirts that said sell. MLB actually censored. It became a little bit of a story. In that game, I think it was in that game, someone hit a home run. And on Twitter, you could see back a long time ago when Twitter used to work, someone had juxtaposed the video feed from the road team's video feed and Oakland's feed or MLB's. It might have been on MLB Network. And the feed on the road team, you could see when the home run was hit, this giant sign that said, sell the team. And when the same thing was shown on either Oakland or MLB TV, they had cut the frame in a way that you couldn't see like that sign. They didn't want anyone to know what's going on. But the point is, there's this reverse boycott. It's by far the biggest crowd of the year. It is a reminder of the passion that does exist for this team. The Oakland A's, when they are good, they're a tremendous fan base. They are, that place is packed. That place is loud. When Oakland has a team to root for, Oakland gets all behind that team. And you would think now that they've lost the Raiders to Las Vegas, that there's probably even more investment just in the Warriors left Oakland now for their big gleaming Taj Mahal across the bay in San Francisco. There's no team left in Oakland besides the A's. So there's added significance to them just being left for that reason. They staged this boycott. It's immensely popular. It brings in this huge, involved, vibrant crowd. And the reporter asks Manfred what he thinks about it. And it's such a cut and dry, like, here is just a softball waiting for you to wallop. Like, the reporter is basically asking you, just talk freely about the incredible, you know, love and passion that these fans who are suffering showed. And instead of taking the opportunity and running with it, Manfred says, quote, it was great. It's great to see what is this year, almost an average Major League Baseball crowd in the facility for one night. That's a great thing. So he has to take shots at them for not averaging a Major League crowd and because it only happened once. Again, with absolutely no regard for the contextual reality that is behind this. In a normal baseball franchise run by ownership who actually want to win and invest in it and are invested in making their fans you know, feel happy and appreciated and involved, you would never get to a point where a reverse boycott would happen. But Manfred acts like it just, I can't remember the word for it now. There's a word for like the ingredient that people used to think happened in like spontaneous combustion. The word for something that some substance people used to just assume existed and it doesn't. And he acts here like there's no cause, there's no cause effect between, huh, why is this normally rabid baseball marketplace so dead now? Could it be the behavior of the owner? No, I'm not going to look at that. I'm just going to take shots at the fans. This is the same Rob Manfred recently who, and I can't remember why he said it this way, but like a year or two ago when a reporter asked, I think it was about the Astros and some question about whether like the meaning of winning the World Series would be compromised because of a cheating scandal. And Manfred like pointed out that the World Series trophy is just a piece of metal. And he's not wrong. He's not wrong. And in some ways, I would applaud a commissioner if he was calling it a piece of metal in a different context. If he was trying to remind people like, hey, it's not just about who wins at the end of the year, but there's so many great stories in baseball and people and so many human narratives, and that really should be the focus. Compared to that, the trophy's just a piece of metal. Like, that would be fine. But the commissioner of the sport should not be calling the trophy that everyone is supposed to be aiming for a piece of metal. This is the smug Rob Manfred that is almost always on display or straining to pop out from behind whatever veil of civility he's presenting at the moment. The other thing he said, again, when asked about blaming Oakland for what happened, he says, I think that the real question is, what is it that Oakland was prepared to do? There is no Oakland offer, okay? They never got to a point where they had a plan to build a stadium at any site. I invite you to go on the internet, if you would like, and to look up all the people who have rebutted this statement. It's not Rob Manfred's finest hour. This whole Oakland A's thing is not Rob Manfred's finest hour. And it just, generally, as a New York sports fan, I have the privilege of not really having to ever be concerned that my teams are going to go anywhere. I cannot remember from the Dodgers and Giants till now the last time a New York City team left the city to go somewhere else. I don't think it's happened. The Islanders played briefly in Brooklyn, and I think now they have a new home back on Long Island. But that's still Long Island, Long Island. Like, it's not the same. It's not like leaving New York to go to California like the Dodgers and Giants did. I don't have to worry generally that my teams might go somewhere. The biggest threats, I think, in my lifetime, George Steinbrenner used to threaten that he was going to move the Yankees to New Jersey whenever he wanted to extract some sort of allowance from New York City. And I think really that's about it. I don't think anyone else has ever really threatened to leave the city. So, but just as a fan who also does care about other fans because they are people, I can't imagine supporting a franchise the way the Oakland fans have support. I mean, Oakland is a centerpiece Major League Baseball franchise since they've existed there. They had in the 70s the Charlie Finley A's teams, which were very famous for being very colorful and very, let's say, experimental with some of their in-game promotional tie-ins and things like that, marketing. They tried a lot of things that other people maybe wouldn't have done. They had the dynasty in the early 70s, the team with, I don't know if Vida Blue was on the A's then. They had Reggie Jackson. They had, I think Catfish Hunter was on those teams. Raleigh Fingers. Just a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous team that was incredible for years. And then in the 80s, you know, the Tony La Russa A's teams with the Bash Brothers and Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco and Ricky Henderson and Dave Stewart and Dennis Eckersley. They were, for years, you know, kind of the bad boys of Major League Baseball. And then later on, you had the teams with Miguel Tejada and Barry Zito and Tim Hudson, Mark Mulder, Jeremy Giambi, like great Jason Giambi, great, great, great teams. There was one year they won like 22 in a row, and I just remember it was a crazy, crazy streak. It hurts as a person who wants to root for a team and wants to invest in a team emotionally and trust that, you know, it seems like a fucked up relationship where if you're in a relationship and, you know, one person continues to feel like, I really value, like, this really means so much to me. This is so central and valuable to me. And the other person's like, you know what? I'm leaving you to go somewhere where I'm going to live in a one-bedroom studio with, like, an outhouse and no electricity. And I'm going to do it because I just have to get away from you. That's hard if you're that person. That's hard if you just know about that person. I very much feel for the Oakland fans dealing with this. It's one of those American pro sports conundrums where it can seem like there is nothing you can do. Like, this billionaire is going to fuck over millions of people because he would trade everything he has for a little more, and there's nothing anyone can do to stop it. So let's focus a little bit instead on the positives from the story, which is to highlight what the people did do and could do at this reverse boycott in response to what's going on. It was, like I said, a real party atmosphere. They had a DJ on site. There were grills. There were coolers. People were flying flags and banners and hugging each other. This is all from The Athletic. There was apparently a game of cornhole with poop emoji beanbags that were being thrown into the mouths of A's owner John Fisher and team president Dave Cavall. The mayor of Oakland was there celebrating with the people. There were free t-shirts, all of which had just the one word sell. It was basically a giant, giant tailgate. And as this article in The Athletic mentioned, it also became, this became a movement. This became a people-organized movement to, again, rebut the idea that we are all just items on a spreadsheet, and the bottom line that matters is not us, it's profit. And this is a real visible demonstration and reminder that that's not the case, that it's too easy to fall. I think especially when you are reading about it in media and just talking about it kind of in a detached way, like happens on a podcast, it can be easy to lose sight of the fact that, like, this is a blood and flesh issue. This is not numbers on a spreadsheet. And even if the person who seems to be pulling the strings is treating it that way, this is like so many of the fights of our time, like right now in the world. It's about affirming for ourselves and reminding them we were here first. We're people. We come first. A man named Jeremy Goodrich, who helped get the boycott going, said, quote, I think that was the most important aspect, because the A's continuously try to make it seem like attendance is their main reason for moving away. What we realized is everyone needs to come together, make this happen, show that we are here, which based on this parking lot shows that we are here, end quote. The boycott raised almost $1 million also for charity. You see all these things that have come about just positively because of humans organizing and engaging with each other as humans instead of sitting back and suffering as individuals. So a sad story is unfolding, but there's a lot of, I think, encouragement to take out of at least the example of what was set. Like, what can we do? You can do that. You can continue to create positive memories for yourself around the idea of the Oakland A's. But then you have also, so as a Met fan, Steve Cohen took over the Mets a couple years ago, and I thought, oh, thank God, because the Mets finally got rid of the Wilpons, who were basically like if Ebenezer Scrooge had a son, and the two of them owned a baseball team, and he was never visited by three ghosts. Oh, my God. Sorry, as I'm doing this podcast, I'm sitting in front of a window upstairs, and this little finch just flew like right literally up to where I am and was giving me the eyeball for a few seconds and then went away. That was I still get excited by finches. So the Wilpons sell, Steve Cohen takes over, and it's like, oh my God, all systems are go, because the Mets went from being owned by a couple of misers to the wealthiest and most free spendingest owner that there is in Major League Baseball. So excited. For the first time since probably I was a kid, the Mets once again were going to function like a proper New York City big market team. Now, unfortunately, it hasn't really worked out so far on the field for the Mets. But more disheartening than that was the instantaneous blowback from the 31 other owners. Maybe 30. Maybe the Steinbrenners had nothing to say. But the blowback from so many teams, so many fans, so much media about, oh my God, this is ruining the sport. Because when Cohen took over, the biggest payroll in baseball had been the Dodgers for years. And the Dodgers were around $250, $275 million, which was the highest in baseball. But it's interesting. If you go back about 20 years in baseball, the highest payroll was the Yankees, up around $200 million. It doesn't seem like the salaries are keeping up with the payroll, because it just seems like $275 million, but whatever. No one's going to accuse the owners of collusion. That's never happened before, he said sarcastically, wondering if the audience knows that in the 1980s, the owners were sued and convicted of collusion and lost a shit ton of money for doing it. Collusion being when the owners worked together kind of informally to artificially depress player salaries. So Steve Cohen takes over, and immediately the Met payroll explodes, goes past the Yankees, goes past the Dodgers, goes past everybody. Major League Baseball's collective bargaining agreement has certain benchmarks in place that if a team spends past a certain amount of money, there's a tax on it. It's meant to disincentivize billionaires from actually spending money. So the Mets blew past all of those benchmarks, which meant incredible tax figures. With payroll and taxes combined, the Mets are spending this year well over $400 million, which is, wow, like so much larger. But in all these other, in almost every other way in our economic system, like what Cohen doing is showing like money talks. Like, I'm here. I know you guys have your rules. I don't care. Like, I have money. I'm going to spend whatever I want to spend. And even though you have rules in place to try to create and control a certain kind of existence, I'm rich. I'm blowing that out of the water because I can. Which is essentially how the wealthy treat the rest of the world. We know you people are trying to live. We know you're trying to exist and function in certain ways. We don't care. We have more money than you do. We're going to push through what we want to make things happen that we want, and we really don't care how it affects you. So it's very funny to me. This is very similar to how Western Europe for forever, hundreds of years, is completely cool with colonization. Like, it's all good. Until Nazi Germany starts to colonize Western Europe, and then, oh, wait a minute, now we don't like colonization so much. So same shit here. These billionaires lean on the weight of their wealth to push through any injustice they have to, as long as it benefits them. But now when there's an owner there doing the same thing, oh my God, he's got to go. He's killing baseball. We need to change the rules again. So there's not even the excitement of, all right, I don't like how much money there is, but at least there is a merit. Like, you would at least like to think there is a merit-based essence to all of this. That if you are going to be super wealthy, voluntarily involved in a business competition with 31 other people, also of incredible means and presumably competitive in this, throw it all out there. You know, do your best, invest, put it all out there, and let's see the chips fall where they may. Won't that be exciting to see? No. So you don't even have the excitement of being able to think like, well, at least my team has someone for whom money is no object and no limit. The sport will find a way to impose limits on this person, which is just, again, such hypocritical bullshit. It's just such more what's good for you guys does not apply to us. It's difficult as a person to support a sport clearly behaving this way. When you take the way they've been toward the Oakland A's fans and you take the fact of like, well, capitalism, you know, maybe for you guys, but we want protected revenue all the time. It's hard to swallow. And it's not just that. The game itself, if you watch a game of baseball in 2023, if you describe it to someone 10 years ago, it would sound unreal. There's a designated hitter in the National League. This is a baseball Puritan thing. If you don't really care about baseball, this won't matter to you. But when baseball was first created, everybody who played also hit, including the pitchers. Over time, every league pretty much on earth, except the National League in MLB, adopted this designated hitter. So pitchers don't have to hit. Pitchers don't really spend time practicing hitting. Most of them are bad at it, very bad at it. So a lot of leagues decide, okay, instead of having the pitcher hit, we're going to have a spot for a player who doesn't have to play in the field. They just hit. And this allows you to keep for years players who maybe are too slow or too banged up or just not graceful enough to really play in the field, but you put a bat in their hand and they can do damage. But the National League, by not having the DH, it creates a very different kind of game, of challenge, because there was so much more strategy involved. In leagues that have a DH, you let a pitcher pitch as long as he can, basically until you think he's out of it, and then you pull him. When pitchers hit, you have to be much more strategic about when you pull them, because depending where the lineup is, I really hope I'm not losing you if you don't care about baseball, but just to explain the point, if your pitcher has to hit, you can't just make a decision about when do I pull him. Oh, he looks tired. I'm going to pull him. It's not that simple, because if you replace him and his spot is coming up in the batting order, you don't want the guy who replaced him to hit. That guy can't hit. He's a pitcher. So you have to be strategic about when do I pull the pitcher, because I want to make sure I have a good hitter ready to go in his slot. And it creates all these kinds of double switches, and very creative managers like Whitey Herzog and Davey Johnson would sometimes have one reliever play in the outfield while another one pitched, and would switch them back and forth position to position depending on whether the hitters were righties or lefties. Davey Johnson did it with Roger McDowell and Jesse Orozco once in a game. When a left-hand hitter was up, Orozco would pitch and he would switch with McDowell. McDowell would go to right field and vice versa. All that is gone when there's no GH. There's just, I can't even think of a comparison to it. It's like chess if there were no pawns. Like, it's just, you've taken away so much of the strategy. So there's no DH anymore. But okay, maybe that's just a whiny, you know, I'm a baseball fossil, only I care about that. Well, one of the beauties of baseball, it is a pre-industrial game. It was the only popular American sport that was invented without a clock. There was no clock in baseball. There's this perennial griping in the media, and MLB feeds into it also. You're supposed to accept without question this idea, this assumption that baseball fans hate to watch baseball. So the games need to be as short as possible because audiences don't have the attention span to put up with a game that goes on too long. Now, they say this at a time where if you watch the NFL games in the course of my lifetime, used to start at 1 o'clock and used to end right around four. They might end a few minutes early, they might end a few minutes late, but it was basically 1 to 4. Now, the games that start at 1 o'clock do not end until closer to 4:30. I have never heard anyone from the NFL or in the media complain that the games are too long. But baseball always has this insecurity that, though, the reason people don't like me is because I go on too long, so I'll make it shorter. But instead of getting rid of things people don't miss, por ejemplo, if you got rid of one commercial from every half inning, you would knock 18 minutes off of the average game time right there. Boom. Beautiful. But again, 9 billion in profit isn't good enough when you could make 10 billion in profit. So the commercials aren't going anywhere, even though nobody needs them. Instead, what we'll do is we're going to add a pitch clock. So for the first time in the history of this game, there is now a clock involved. And the pitchers and the batters have to be ready to go within a very specific number of seconds, or else they're penalized. And thus, the game has been industrialized, which is now paving the way for any year now we're supposed to have these robot umpires. It's not as exciting as it sounds. It's not like, you know, the robots and the Jetsons are going to be out there on the bases. It just means that you will have an automated strike zone and a computer will tell you if it's a ball or a strike. I don't want this. There's ghost runners now. One of the great glories of watching a baseball game, particularly in the summer as a child, and this is the summer pod episode, so I'm tying it all back together, baby. In the summer, one of the glories of baseball the glories of baseball for me as a child, especially in the summer, watching a game where you don't have school tomorrow, you don't have to be up early for anything, you're able to stay up later than usual. Here's this game with no clock that also offers kind of exceptions to all of its rules that allow for drama to intensify. So, for example, in baseball, you learn, if you get 3 strikes, you're out. The first time I ever saw a hitter get 2 strikes, and then he hit a foul ball, and I thought he was out because a foul ball was a strike. And my dad explained to me, no, like, you can only get foul balls or a strike for strike one or strike two. But strike three, you can't be called out on a foul ball. So I'm like, well, what happens for a foul ball? Oh, you just get to go again. My mind exploded at that moment, recognizing the dramatic possibility of, so it can be 3-2 with the bases loaded in the last game of the World Series, and everyone on earth can be watching, and the pitcher gears up and throws it, and the batter hits a foul ball, and all that emotional investment now doubles because you have to do it again. That's tremendously exciting and beautiful stuff if you actually care about what you are watching. Extra innings in baseball is incredible. It's the perfect, there's almost nothing like it. Football all the time is trying to tweak the rules to overtime because no matter what they do, someone has a gripe that it's not fair. Well, it used to be whoever scores first wins. Well, that's not fair because what if one team gets the ball first and they score right away? The other team doesn't even get a chance. I never understood griping about that. They just had 60 minutes to win the game. If you lose in overtime, you lose. But football will bend itself into a pretzel trying to accommodate every possible permutation of overtime to make sure it's as fair as it. And in baseball, it's already built that way. You go to extra innings, both teams are guaranteed a shot. 10th inning, the road team is going to get a chance to score. So is the home team. They're always going to get the same number of, it's built into the fabric of the game itself. It is designed so that they both get the same number of chances. The most incredible game I have ever seen in my life still was a 16-inning game between the Mets and Astros in 1986. It was game 6 of the National League playoffs. The Mets won the game, which sent them on to the World Series, but they had been losing 3-0 in the first inning, and they were losing 3-0 all the way to the ninth inning. And everyone knew if the Mets lost that game, they were done, because the pitcher they were going to have to face the next day, Sky Mike Scott, was cheating with his split finger fast, a scuffball. And everybody knew, like, the Mets were the best team on the planet that year by a mile. But the one player in baseball that they could not handle was Mike Scott. And if they lost this game to the Astros, they were going to lose the next game to Mike Scott and be done. And they're down 3-0 in the ninth inning. They tie it in the ninth inning. Nobody scores for the next four innings. In the 14th inning, the Mets take the lead. In the bottom of the 14th, the Astros get a home run to tie it at four. In the 16th inning, the Mets score three runs to go up 7-4. In the bottom of the 16th inning, the Astros score two runs and get two people on base before they finally lose. It was an incredible marathon, emotional, like, epic. And baseball has now introduced ghost runners so that this can never happen again. Because, again, we can't have the games go too long, because why would you want to give baseball fans more baseball? So now, in extra innings, there's a runner on second base to start. As soon as you go to extra innings, there's a runner on second. Because baseball wants to shorten the game, and it does that. And they will argue that this is also about player safety. Bullshit. But they'll say that, well, we don't want games to go too long because, you know, teams end up burning out their pitchers that way. So if we do it this way, at least no one's getting their arms. No one's arm is going to fall off. But you're just like, when did that become a problem? Because for literally over 100 years, it wasn't a problem. Everybody dealt with it. And the fans enjoyed it. There was tremendous anticipation. You're in extra innings. Now all the stakes are raised. Everything now is magnified. Now it's almost impossible for a game to go longer than 10 innings, because if you look at the numbers, the probability, when you start out an inning with a man on second base and nobody out, you're going to score a lot of the time. So you've taken another thing that was unique and special about the game, and you've killed it. And it's not just me. The Athletic did a poll with over 100 major league players just maybe a week ago or so ago. They asked them about the pitch clock. 60%, slightly more than 60% of the players polled thought that the pitch clock should either be extended or eliminated altogether in the playoffs. And three quotes. One player said, quote, every pitch means so much in the postseason. You want that dramatic tension to be able to build. Another pitcher said, and this is, you want to talk about player safety, you're getting to hear from the players themselves. Another player said, quote, I wouldn't mind seeing 20 seconds between pitches with nobody on and 25 or 30 with people on. In the postseason, every pitch is so magnified. There are high-stress pitches being thrown, and you're making them rush through it, and it can potentially get dangerous. That is true. But that doesn't seem to freak them out. And then lastly, and sadly, this is not just a baseball thing. God knows the NHL is also trying to rival baseball here for just sheer social cowardice. The Texas Rangers of Major League Baseball, like most Major League Baseball teams, host a number of community/theme nights during the season. They have a Choctaw Casinos and Resorts night. They have a Harry Potter night. They have Abilene Christian University night. And they've also even had Vegan Day. But what the Texas Rangers will not permit on their watch is there will be no Pride Night. 29 Major League teams hold Pride Night. Texas is one of apparently three who do not. They are the only Texas professional sports franchise who does not host a Pride Night. So it's not just it's not a Texas thing. It's easy to be like, Texas. No, this isn't Texas. And remember, I just read earlier today, Texas has the second largest LGBTQ adult population in the country, almost 2 million people, I believe. This is not a Texas thing. This is a Texas Rangers thing. The Houston Astros, their in-state major league partner, used to not have one. They started doing one last year. And according to his article in The Athletic, it has been a driver of both ticket sales and sponsor revenue. The LA Dodgers, who've had major controversy this year going back and forth with the, I think they're called the Sisters of Mercy, which is a group that has been involved at least since the 1980s in bringing significant financial, personal, medical care and love to, in the 80s, I know they helped a lot with people that were dying from the HIV crisis. They've kind of always since then been involved in trying to help the most oppressed groups on the queer continuum. The Dodgers have gone back and forth with inviting them to appear at a game and then not letting them come and then re-inviting them. And even the Dodgers, though, like they still have Pride Night. Texas Rangers, no. And it's just, I feel like I've given you a lot of negativity. Let me leave you with what I'm going to call the So Shines a Good Deed in a Weary World segment, based on the great line from late in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, when Charlie and Grandpa Joe are just about to leave Wonka's office, and Charlie's grandfather sounds like, you know what, we're going to bring this gobstopper to Slugworth. Screw Wonka. And Charlie refuses to do so. He leaves the Everlasting Gobstopper with Wonka, and they start to walk out, and Gene Wilder takes it in his hand and whispers, "So shines a good deed in a weary world." So here's your good deed for today's pod, also from the world of baseball. There was a player about 10, 15 years ago on the St. Louis Cardinals, third baseman by the name of David Freese. David Freese was a pretty good player. Not a legend as far as baseball players go, but he was a very good pro, and he was particularly an important player in St. Louis, which is his hometown. In 2011, Freese played for the Cardinals when they won the World Series. He was the MVP of the World Series. He was also the MVP of the National League Championship Series, which is the round before the World Series. He hit just about 400 with 5 home runs in the postseason that year, which is incredible. The Cardinals in the World Series were down to their last out against those pride-hating Texas Rangers when he hit a two-run triple that tied the score in the bottom of the ninth inning. And then 2 innings later, that's right, longer extra innings later in the 11th, he hit a home run that won Game 6, forced a winner-take-all Game 7. That's a game the Cardinals won 6-2. Freese had a two-run double in it. So he's not... David Freese would never get in the Baseball Hall of Fame. He's not that great of a player. But in terms of impact on Cardinal history, particularly this century, outsized, positive, enormous contributions by him. So the fans in St. Louis, they get to vote every year on players that they want to elect to the Cardinal Hall of Fame, the team-specific Hall of Fame. And this year, David Freese got more votes than anybody else. I think 3 players qualified. 3 players will be inducted, but Freese got the most votes. Freese rejected the honor. He said, quote, "I look at who I was during my tenure, and that weighs heavily on me. The Cardinals and the entire city have always had my back in every way. I'm forever grateful to be part of such an amazing organization and fan base, then, now, and in the future. I'm especially sorry to the fans that took the time to cast their votes." So not only does he have the perspective, like, this is amazing to me. Not only does he have the perspective of, you know what, you guys have gone too far. I love you. I'll always love you. But we all know I'm not on that level. He doesn't need to say that. Like, he's a retired professional athlete. He's never going to get the cheers and the adoration that he had throughout his life. This man was a a major league, an above average major league player, which means since he's been like a kid, he has been getting cheered and told how great he is and you know, treated like a social better by a lot of people his whole life. He retires. You don't get the cheers anymore. You don't get the adoration, the adulation. And the city, your hometown, reaches out again to be like, no, no, you are that great. You're, and you have the perspective and the in this, this the self perspective to say, thank you, but I really don't. I really don't deserve it. Other people do. I don't. And to also have the perspective to end it with, to apologize to the fans, recognizing like, look, I know this means something to you. Like, I know what a big deal this is to you. I know you didn't treat it lightly by electing me to this honor. I'm not dismissing it lightly. This is an enormous decision that I had to make here, but I think it's the right one. I think that's very, very cool. Not because he's an athlete. I think a lot of us would be challenged in that situation not to be like, I'm not that good. Like, you know, I've had some little stories published. I'm not anything special in the world of writing, but like I've had a few things published. If I got an email from someone who was like, hey, we want to host a night in your honor at the downtown, you know, Marriott, we're just all so amazed by the iconoclastic brilliance. I would be like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, but if it's free, like, I'll probably go. I definitely respect David Freese for showing like there is such a thing as enough. Like, even a person like him who's made all this money and has just gotten so much in life retains the capacity to say, that's too much. Like, I've had enough. So much respect to David Freese. That's all for this episode of the Jackman Sports Show. keep an ear out for newer episodes. Follow us on Twitter at Jackman Sports. Email the show, jackmansports@gmail.com. I have a limerick for you. There once was a Patreon at patreon.com/Jackman Sports Show with fat, juicy lips that would make you go, whoa. Something stirs in your loins? That's your passion to join. Take care of that urge ASAP, yo. I don't know if it's a great limerick, but the point is, please join the Patreon if you haven't. Pressure other people to join the Patreon if you haven't. Patreon. That's all for this episode. Love you all. We'll be in touch again soon. Enjoy your early July.